then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the...
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's June the 23rd, 2011. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
There beside the singing river, that dark mass of men were seen, far above their shining weapons, on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune, and hurrah, my voice for freedom, 'tis the rising of the moon.
During his recent trial for his life, Edgar Steele was offered a choice between a drunk and a thief as his defense counsel, which is pretty typical for the United States criminal justice system. Ed and Cindy Steele chose the thief, and apparently chose wrong, although there's certainly no indication that the drunk could have done any better.
The following is a press release from the Steele family regarding the incident Harold is speaking of. It can be found at the official Free Edgar Steele website at freeedgarsteele.com. Edgar Steele, his family, friends, and supporters wish to express their serious disappointment and outrage upon hearing of the disbarment of Mr. Steele's attorney, Robert McAllister. They view this as a betrayal of their trust placed in him. It is unconscionable that he failed to disqualify himself before he put Mr. Steele at risk of conviction on false charges. After several months of alleged representation by federal public defender Roger Peavin, those close to Mr. Steele's case came to realize Mr. Peavin's efforts were marginal at best. He was simply trying to make Mr. Steele take a plea bargain and had no intention of defending him from the fraudulent charges. The observation was that his so-called representation was fraught with procrastination, even inattentiveness. A sad irony exists that after Peavin was off the case, he found himself in the limelight of negative publicity for an alcohol problem and for doing the same thing to others. When Mr. McAllister's name came forward with positive recommendations, many found new optimism that an aggressive offense on the false charges would be mounted to defend and then free Mr. Steele. Observers of McAllister's performance at trial in Boise naturally had justifiable questions and criticism of defense opportunities that were passed by. He simply failed to ask the hard questions as if he was distracted by something else, so that he could not properly perform as Mr. Steele's attorney. Cindy Steele and her family wished to go on record saying they were completely unaware of any impropriety in Mr. McAllister's personal or professional dealings outside of his representing Edgar Steele. In fact, they were caught off guard and surprised when news of disbarment was announced. Mr. Steele is now represented by Mr. Wesley Hoyt, attorney practicing in Colorado and Idaho. Mr. Hoyt has extensive defense experience with Idaho businessman David Hinkson, who is currently imprisoned as a result of similar governmental judicial frame-up and railroading, and hopes to use that experience to point out the errors and misconduct that caused the conviction of Mr. Steele.
You know, I read in the media that the shambling drunk Roger Peavin was getting paid $155,000 per year in taxpayers' money to defend Edgar Steele from the same regime that fabricated the whole ridiculous case against him in the first place. Now, this whole public defender system has always struck me as a gross conflict of interest. Who in their right mind would trust an attorney who is being paid his salary by the very people who are trying to destroy the defendant's life? I think I may revert to my original advice given in the March Up Country many years ago. When they come for you, if you're so fortunate as to be allowed a public trial at all, and some people aren't, like Jeff Hughes and Vicki Weaver and Kathy Ainsworth, you need to defend yourself. Don't let the government appoint a drunk to do it, and don't hire some thief who will do nothing except sit around in court looking like a deer caught in the headlights before you're dragged off to death and torture, and he sends your wife a six-figure bill. You know, one last comment. The Edgar Steele case is living, absolute proof that this system does not work. Democracy does not work. The court system, the justice system, is irretrievably broken and cannot be fixed from within. Now, all of us know what will work, and we're simply too chicken shit terrified to do it. And because we are so timid and frightened, this old man is going to have to die in prison. Because none of us have the courage to raise our hands against the enemy and do what has to be done. And I just don't know what to say about this case. To say that it makes me angry to the point of raving insanity would be not excessively, well, whatever. Okay, before we go any further, I do want to read an email I got from Colonel House on a musical comment that I made a couple of shows ago. I mentioned that I don't know who the person using the name Johnny Rebel on YouTube was. He's the guy who did Ship Those Niggers Back in Coontown, but the Colonel keeps up with these things, and he writes as follows. Johnny Rebel is the pseudonym of Cajun country musician Clifford Joseph Trahan, born October the 3rd, 1938, also known as Pee Wee Trahan. Trahan used this pseudonym most notably on racist recordings issued in the 1960s on J.D. J. Miller's Reb Rebel label of Crowley, Louisiana. Trahan's first release, the fifth for the Reb Rebel label, was a 45 RPM single of Looking for a Handout and Cajun Ku Klux Klan. He would record five more singles for the label, which included Nigger Nigger, In Coontown, Who Likes a Nigger, Nigger Hatin' Me, Still Looking for a Handout, Some Niggers Never Die, They Just Smell That Way, Stay Away from Dixie, and Move Them Niggers North. Obviously, this must be from a Wikipedia entry of some kind. These songs were eventually issued in album format by Reb Rebel Records under the title For Segregationists Only. After hiatus of about 3 decades, Trahan returned as Johnny Rebel in 2001 when he issued his CD single Infidel Anthem, recorded in response to the September 11th, 2001 attacks. In 2003, Trahan released the album It's the Attitude, Stupid, on the Try It Man record label. So, from now on, when I play Johnny Rebel stuff on here, you guys will know who I'm talking about. Okay, I suppose I should reserve the second and third sections of the podcast for my own rants and raves. So let's see who else we've got on the schedule for this week. Okay, here's a book review for us by Gretchen the Librarian.
Good evening, comrades. Well, I've read both the Hans Gunther books, so this week I'm going to talk about both of them. The Religious Attitudes of Indo-Europeans is a book that surveys all the native Indo-European religions. It ferrets out all of the unique characteristics of these religions. The author decides that the unifying characteristics is the embrace of destiny, both in terms of individual and racial destiny, and finding a sanctity within the world. Now, he says in the immature form that this can be pantheism, this can be guardian spirits, but as time goes on, it really becomes an inner mysticism. And he contrasts this with Christianity and Islam, which are religions that have more to do with either converting to a revelation or, in the case of Christianity, having a savior that redeems a fallen world. So, all in all, because I've studied various Indo-European religions, I would say that this book was really not that surprising. The author talks about the inner goodness, the nobility of the free yeoman farmer, which he thinks is the ultimate in terms of self-governance and the ability for self-governance. Now, this author is a Nordicist, so you have to understand that attitude pervades the work. And The author really does not like any kind of industrialized society, doesn't like life in the cities, and is critical of any mass movement. So in the last chapter, which surprised me somewhat, Gunther is critical of National Socialism. So when I read that, it surprised me a little. And at that point, I wanted to know, well, if this author is uncomfortable with National Socialist ideology, then what exactly does this author propose? In a sense, because obviously there is a crisis, and even at the time this book was being written, there is a crisis of Western society that must be dealt with. So what does the author want, if not that solution? So then I read The Racial Elements of European History, and mainly it's just a survey of the various races of Europe. And again, he's a Nordicist, so his view of the Nordics tend to be the glowing. But he also acknowledges the capabilities, the passionate creativity of the Mediterraneans, which is different than the restrained inward creativity of the Nordics. And he also has a respect for the Dinaric race. So I read through the book. I'm trying to figure out, well, what is Gunther's solution? Because in The Racial Elements of European History, he talks about how the Nordics are always, you know, together and in their own societies, they flourish. But when they go out and try to claim new territories, they tend to spread themselves too thin. They become too individualistic, and often they go to war, and eventually they start to die out. Always, this is a crisis. So what does he suggest? I mean, if he's saying there's this crisis, how do we sustain the Nordic race, which he believes is the most valuable of all the European sub-races? At the end of the book, he ends up endorsing eugenic societies. So he does endorse that very enthusiastically. And he talks about Nordics who live for their race so that they can embrace both their personal and racial destiny. So in a sense, it seems to come full circle. In one book, he criticizes National Socialist ideology. And then in Racial Elements, he seems to say that he seems to transvalidate the value of Nordicism. So then I'm asking myself, well, what exactly is his problem with National Socialism? And I'm guessing that he fears military dictatorship, and that's really what he's worried about, and not so much the ideology itself. So I found books to be very engrossing, although The Racial Elements of European History is a little difficult to read because of the way he talks throughout the book about this tragedy of the Nordics, this flaw or this problem with Nordic character between individual freedom the Nordics in particular love so much, but then the need to maintain Nordics. So I enjoyed both books, and I would recommend them, but I do warn you that, as I've said probably 3 or 4 times, he is a Nordicist, so if that would offend you, then perhaps you would not enjoy these books. But otherwise, there's lots of footnotes, and I'm sure you'll learn a lot from them. So thank you for listening, comrades.
Now, another email I got this week on a topic I've addressed several times in the past, but I'm happy to have another go at it. It goes, Dear HAC, I am in England. I would gladly take passage to the Northwest homeland, stake a claim, and defend and live the cause. But how do I get past U.S. immigration? As a white man of the race that founded the United States, I will be low in the pecking order when applying for a green card, and I have no idea how long that would take. I have a few minor convictions earned from street activist politics in the 80s and 90s. Will these strike out any hope of obtaining a green card? As the homeland is in its infancy, I'm realistic that were I to turn up and live illegally, I would become a liability. Living on the wrong side of the law, for all the right reasons, encourages me. It has been in my blood since childhood to view the world through a racial lens. Signed, Ilios. Okay, first off, on the whole subject of European immigration to America. Once more, I remind you that the Radio Free Northwest podcast for July 1st, 2010, that's almost a year ago, July 1st, 2010, Anyway, in that episode, I discuss at some length the issue of European immigration, the kinds of visas, the problems in dealing with the ICE over here, immigration lawyers, so forth and so on. So you might want to download and listen to that podcast first, Ilios. I'm not an expert, and I'm not an immigration attorney, and you can probably find out better information on the internet than you can get from me, but this is just a white nationalist perspective on immigration based on my own experience. Now, in the past, I have spoken with some skepticism about white people's chances of coming here and getting legalized. This cynicism is based not just on certain spectacular and high-profile cases like Germar Rudolph and Ernst Zundel and Hendrik Mubus and the Heretical Two, but also, like I said, on my personal experience in trying to get my own Irish wife and later on my New Zealand girlfriend in here legally, and also on what's called anecdotal evidence, i.e., what people have told me about the process who've been through it, usually with only very limited success. However, since I mentioned this subject last, let's just be fair here, I have been contacted by several people who tell me either that they're Brits living in America or they know Brits living in America, and their rap is that while the U.S. immigration process is indeed annoying and time-consuming, it can be done. And these people or their friends were able to get their green cards by working the system and jumping through the hoops and using their immigration lawyers where necessary to avoid the main hoop, which is the absurd demand that you leave the country before they'll adjust your visa status. Of course, once you leave, you're pretty much at their mercy. They can either let you back in or not as they please, which is the kind of power that these petty bureaucrats love to have over people. Immigration bureaucrats hate people who just come and then try and get their status changed while they're here. It's like they didn't show them proper respect, you see. They didn't bow down and bow and scrape and lick their boots and, "Please, please let me in." One British comrade told me he was able to get a student visa converted to a work legal visa and then a green card without too much trouble. It was just a lot of forms and about $1,000 in fees. Took him about 6 months. Now, another guy swears to me that he was able to marry an American and then get a tourist visa converted to a green card without having to leave the country, which I believe is technically and legally supposed to be not possible, but he says he was able to do it with about $2,000 to an immigration lawyer. Now, all of these people tell me that you need to go ahead and surrender to the inevitable and hire the lawyer right from the get-go. They say it's actually not too expensive, and you get these quickie immigration specialty legal firms who specialize in immigration law. They'll usually have something like a $599 package deal in which they'll fill out all the forms for you, get all your documents together, submit them to the right government offices, etc. If they do provide this service, it probably would be worth it. Now, you know, this sounds to me like the Obama regime is greasing the slides for all these millions of Mexicans and Guatemalans and Somalis and whatever that we've got in this country, the ones that they want to get legalized so they can vote Democrat and make sure that we basically become a one-party state with perpetual power to the Democrat Party. Now, Lord knows, illegal immigrants have got the money for these law firms, just like they've got the money to buy these big, huge monster pickup trucks with the salsa music blaring out of them. And it could be that the massive amnesty and legalization of illegals that the Democrats want is, in fact, going on already right under our nose as part of a Democrat Party scam to sneak in effective amnesty, what amounts to an amnesty through the back door, without having to bother with Congress. In other words, basically, Obama just tells the Immigration and Naturalization Service, the ICE, and so forth, just, hey, you know, from now on, just anybody that wants to get legal, take the money and give them the necessary, you know, green card and whatnot. Just don't look into their background. Don't look into their employment prospects. Don't look into anything. Just go ahead, take the money, stamp the documents, and make them citizens. It could be that that's how they're getting around the necessity of having to openly amnesty these creatures, and that is they're just quietly opening the floodgates to legal immigration. And if that's the case, then white migrants may have a chance to sneak in as well. So if you British and European guys really want to come here, and this is really what's happening, then maybe you ought to take advantage of it. I mean, hell, if any Juan, Jose, and Carlos can come here and just pay $599 to an immigration attorney and end up getting made a citizen 6 months later so he can vote Democrat, oh, why shouldn't you? I know these procedures are probably intended to benefit new immigrants with skins the color of shit, but hey, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. So you guys from Europe that want to come here, hey, give it a shot. Who knows what'll happen?
Immigration scene, shining and feeling clean. Could it be a sin? I got stopped by the immigration man. He said he doesn't know if he can. Let me in, let me in. Immigration man, can I cross the line and break? I can stay another day. Immigration man, I won't tow your line today. I can't see it anyway. Here he was with his immigration face, giving me a paper chase, but the sun was coming. To my space, stamped a number over my face, and it sent me running. Won't you let me in, immigration man? Can I cross the line and break? I can stay another day. Won't you let me in, immigration man? I won't tow your line today. I can't see it anyway. My immigration form is big enough to keep me warm when the cold wind's coming. So go where you will, as long as you think you can. You better watch out for the man. Anywhere you're going, come on and let me in. Immigration man, can I cross the line and pray? Take your fingers from the train. Man, I won't tow your line today. I can't see it anyway.
Why does it have to be the Northwest? Recently, we got an email from a comrade back east named Dave who asked a question we hear a lot here at the Northwest Front. Dave's email asks, quote, "But does it have to be the Northwest? Could Mr. Covington's idea not be expounded upon elsewhere? Could right-thinking white folk not come together anywhere and, through lawful elections and selective migration, create the beginnings of a homeland to start something, to give our future generations something to further develop and be proud of? Why not?" Well, Dave, actually, there are some very good reasons why the white homeland has to be here in the Pacific Northwest. Bear in mind that our objective here is to create a viable nation for white people and to avoid small, non-viable, surrounded enclaves. That means that the new homeland for our folk has to meet several important criteria. Number one, the homeland must be big enough to grow into over many generations. Lebensraum, as it were. That lets out New England. Number two, it must be a contiguous, all-white landmass. Enclaves would eventually be overrun. That lets out Matt Hale's everybody move to Peoria and take over the county idea. Number three, there must be sufficient natural resources and infrastructure to support, feed, and clothe a growing nation and create industry. That rules out New England as well. The Northwest presently has most of what we will need, and we can jury-rig the rest. Towards the end in Rhodesia, the white people there were manufacturing everything from their own steel to their own scotch. It was only a failure of political will that destroyed the country. Number four, the new nation must have an extensive coastline with viable deep-water harbors. It must not be landlocked and dependent on flight over hostile territory for communication with the outside world. We will also need access to the sea for commercial fishing and desalinization and mineral extraction, all of which will be necessary in the 21st century. Number 5. Remember, the Northwest idea was not invented by Mr. Covington. It's been around for about 20 years, and all unsung, there is in fact migration already going on, including a fair amount of overt, racially conscious migration, especially by religious people to Idaho and northern Utah. There is also a large amount of organic migration on the part of conservative white people who will not openly admit, yet, to racial feelings, but who are basically fleeing the mud flow, especially from California. Number 6. The land of the Northwest is already sanctified with the blood of martyrs such as Vicky and Sam Weaver, Gordon Call, Bob Matthews, and Richard Butler. We cannot and should not turn away from this legacy, which has been given to us by some of the few truly heroic white people of this generation, and we owe it to them to make sure they did not suffer in vain. You know, Harold, this is one of those frequently asked question type of things, and we get this a lot from people who basically say, "Why can't we have our own homeland here where I am already so I don't have to move? And yet you went all the way to Rhodesia in Africa when there was a white country there."
Yes, well, to some degree, it was the same problem we have today. Back in those days, there actually were two overt white countries, South Africa and Rhodesia, and I eventually lived in both, but most American so-called racial nationalists, even back then, talked the talk, but they wouldn't walk the walk. Now, in the 1970s, most American white nationalists supported Rhodesia and South Africa with their mouth, but when it came to the point of actually giving up what they had in this country, all the money and the luxury and the toys and whatnot, and going to the trouble and inconvenience and risk of packing all their stuff and moving to where they were actually needed in the struggle, they found the same kind of excuses to do nothing that we're hearing today regarding the Northwest. And I'll tell you something else. When we do eventually win independence for the Northwest American Republic, as we will do, despite the horror show that life in the rest of America is going to be after that, I'd be willing to bet you that thousands of these so-called white nationalists, these warriors of the computer keyboard, still won't pack the moving van and move to a white country even when one is available. That's us. We're nothing but goddamn talk. This week, I received an email of the kind that fills me with joy and relief that somewhere, by at least a few people, my message is being heard and understood. The email goes, "Dear Harold, some may say, quote-unquote, don't talk about all that stuff, but all that stuff is what has held us back for 50 years and the reason we never get anywhere. How will we ever solve the problem if we don't talk about it?" Signed, Brian in New York. Yes! Yes! By George, I think he's got it! My very point, dealing with our racial character problems is like dealing with alcoholism or drug addiction. You can't deal with a problem until you admit that you have a problem and until you want to change. A lot of what I've been saying over the past 30 years or so about internal movement affairs and the character issue has been for the purpose of trying to get us to admit that the problem exists. Anyone who's been in the movement for any length of time knows it and will usually pay at least lip service to the idea of character so long as no names are mentioned and so long as no one actually talks about specific incidents and specific details as to who did what and how grotty it is. Now, I do mention these things, and for those of you who still contact me every now and then and ask, "Harold, why does everybody in the movement hate you?" Well, that's why, because I name names, I don't let the guilty off the hook, and I refuse to discreetly look the other way while people who claim to be white nationalists piss all over the floor and stagger around and generally make fools of themselves and the cause. I also have a problem communicating, except in writing. The professionalization thing I was talking about last week is a perfect example. Yesterday morning, I was talking in person with a good comrade about the subject of professionalization, trying to explain to him exactly what the hell I was talking about, and I admit I didn't do very well. I do have a problem expressing myself verbally. I knew exactly what I wanted to say. I know exactly what I want to see happen in order to professionalize this party and get this show on the road, but I express it very badly. Now, part of that, of course, is a certain necessity for me to use circumlocutions and not talk in public on here about a lot of things because, yes, I know the enemy listens to Radio Free Northwest. It's like I said last week, what I have to say is so important that I have to do a balancing act. I have to counterbalance the urgent necessity for the people who need to hear me talk about these things to hear it against the potential harm when the people who don't need to hear it, if you get what I'm saying here. Now, it certainly doesn't help my comprehensibility when I can't actually spell out what I mean in words of one syllable, but I'm sorry, we have this little show here every week, and the majority of the listeners here are all sincere white nationalists in their many weird ways, and only a small minority of these people are Jews or secret police or SPLC or whatever, the potential harmfuls, but somehow I have to figure out a way to reach the thousands of real nationalists and to try and shake some sense into them and make myself understood without giving away anything that's going to let these hostiles actually do harm to us. Now, part of it is also my own inability to share a vision with other people, to make them see what I see. What you have to understand, folks, is that I can see all of this I've been talking about for all this time so clearly that it balks and frustrates me when no one else can see it as well. Now, they say that an autistic child bangs his head against the wall and runs on destructive rampages, tearing up everything, largely because he is so frustrated and enraged at his inability to communicate with those around him. Now, that's me. I become so frustrated and enraged over my inability to communicate this truth, this vision of a white homeland in the Northwest that I can see so clearly that I start to stutter, so to speak. I lose coherence trying to convey all this to you guys in a big rush of ideas that no one seems to get except me and Europeans. Now, this is why I love working and chatting with Europeans so much. Europeans get it. They get it the first time. Racial nationalism and separatism are in their political blood. Europeans don't have to be told what I mean. They already know. I don't have to explain it to them over and over and over again while I watch their eyes glaze over and get nothing but slack-jawed, uncomprehending faces like I do with Americans. The Northwest Republic, our future victory, the homeland, and the future that we can make here, I know this is possible. I can see it so clearly, and yet, apparently, nobody else in my own country can, except for a tiny, tiny number of people, about 3,500 a week thus far, according to the stat counter on the website. Yeah, I know, we're down a bit due to summer slump. The weather's nice outside, and more people are going outdoors, and fewer are sitting behind their computers looking for entertainment. Americans can't comprehend what I'm saying. They can't wrap their minds around it, not just because they've been dumbed down by the Jews, rather worse than Europeans, which they have, but because, unlike me, the overwhelming majority of American white nationalists have never traveled, not even traveled much within the United States itself, most of them, and they've never seen or experienced anything else but all this crap. They have grown up with nothing else but this toilet we live in, and they simply cannot imagine anything else, ever. I think almost all American white nationalists, in their heart of hearts and in the privacy of their own thoughts, are convinced that this we see all around us, from the McDonald's hamburgers to the mindless TV, the SUVs and the freeways and the stupid electoral politics between Democrats and Republicans every 4 years and the Six Flags and blah, 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 reaching the age of 50 with a couple of divorces and working your whole life to support kids who've been taught to hate you, the whole American experience, basically, they think this is going to last forever. I think most white Americans, nationalist or racialist or politically aware or otherwise, genuinely believe that, as Francis Fukuyama said, this is the end of history, and that they are going to live out their lives and die in a world that is in no way substantially different from the one they were born into, except that everybody will be a lot more poor. Nobody will have any medical insurance. The machines and the gadgets won't work anywhere near as good as they used to when we were younger. Be a lot more potholes in the streets. Can't really go out after dark, and there will be niggers and Mexicans everywhere by the time we die. In other words, most Americans foresee a long, slow decline, but no real actual change in the country itself. And if that's what's going to happen, then the smart thing to do, of course, is just hunker down and try and entertain yourself while it all goes to hell around you. And most white Americans simply do not seem to be capable of seeing any other possible future than that. We're convinced that we don't have any hope at all ever to change anything, so why bother? Yeah, we go through the motions with this little Northwest Front thing, we get the newsletter, we listen to Harold rant and rave every week. Every now and then we drop Harold $10 in the mail because he rant and rave so good and entertaining, but come on, now we all know nothing's ever really going to come of this, right? Right? I mean, it's not like anyone's ever actually going to do any of this stuff, and we all know that, so don't want to put anything really serious on the table because you might lose it. And so you sit and listen, and sometimes you applaud and tip me like a waiter, but your butts remain firmly planted in your seats, and the prophecy becomes self-fulfilling. Nobody ever does anything because nobody ever does anything. You know, I spoke just now about my inability to communicate, and this is one reason why. It's my tendency to go off on long, rambling digressions just like that one. So I'll see if I can get myself back down to the point of what I intended to talk about this week, which is a continuation of last week's rather disjointed remarks on the subject of professionalizing the Northwest Front as a proper party. Now, I said it last week, and I'll say it again this week. We have got to get this show on the road. Now, despite what I said just now, yes, there is some progress being made, but it simply is not happening fast enough, and we are running out of time. Now, more people are coming. I just received another email this morning from a man on the East Coast who completed his scouting trip to northern Idaho in the Spokane area. Now, he and his family fell completely in love with the place. He tells me they're already back east again. They're starting to clean out the garage and pack stuff for shipping, and they started that as soon as they got back home. Now, I don't think this guy's yanking my chain. He strikes me as a very serious individual, and I think he and his family really are coming. There are others who are making their scouting trips this summer. I notice they're still pretty much avoiding the area where I myself am, probably because they're afraid that if they come here to within half an hour's drive of me, I'll make demands on them, and they're right, I will. They're also probably afraid that if they're around me, they might, quote-unquote, get in trouble, and yes, they might. Hence all the interest in parts of the homeland where Harold is not. But that's fine. North Idaho and southern Oregon and eastern Washington need white settlers just as much as the Puget Sound area does. But events are catching up to us now, and we're running out of time. We have to speed this up. I have been racking my brain trying to figure out some way in which I can convey to you people out there some sense of urgency about this. So far, I haven't been very successful. But this summer, I'm finally going to sit back and address this whole issue and see if we can figure out any way to jumpstart this thing and if we can get any kind of response from you people besides emails saying, gee, Harold, I like your podcasts. I'm going to talk about this at some length, and this is the point where I probably will be getting into more detail than I should, considering who's listening, but not enough detail to satisfy those of you who are basically looking for movement entertainment and vicarious thrills. That's another thing we get quite a lot of in the movement. Hobbyists and dabblers who want to feel a little frisson and thrill of danger by getting emails from mysterious and dubious characters like Harold Covington and pretending to be part of some big underground movement like you're living the Turner Diaries or something. And needless to say, with most of these people, if two real cops or FBI agents ever did knock on their door, they'd shit in their own pants in sheer terror, and they'd hand over their hard drives and fall down on their knees and kiss the FBI's Gucci loafers begging for mercy. But like I said, there are enough sincere and potentially worthwhile people who listen to Radio Free Northwest to where I have to take a chance, and so here goes. But first, here's Canada's greatest folk singer, the late Stan Rogers, with a song we may need to adopt as kind of our unofficial anthem.
Ah, for just one time, I would take the Northwest Passage to find the hand of Franklin reaching for the Beaufort Sea. Tracing one warm line through a land so wide and savage, and make a Northwest Passage to the sea. Westward from the Davis Strait, 'tis there 'twas said to lie, the sea route to the Orient, for which so many died, seeking gold and glory, leaving weathered broken bones, and a long forgotten lonely cairn of stones. Ah, for just one time, I would take the Northwest Passage to find the hand of Franklin reaching for the Beaufort Sea. Tracing one warm line through a land so wide and savage, and make a Northwest Passage to the sea. 3 centuries thereafter, I take passage over land in the footsteps of brave Kelso, where his sea of flowers began, watching cities rise before me, then behind me sink again. This tardiest explorer, driving hard across the plain, ah, for just one time, I would take the Northwest Passage to find the hand of Franklin reaching for the Beaufort Sea. Tracing one warm line through a land so wide and savage, and make a Northwest Passage to the sea. And through the night behind the wheel, the mileage clicking west, I think upon Mackenzie, David Thompson, and the rest, who cracked the mountain ramparts and did show a path for me to race the roaring Fraser to the sea. Ah, for just one time, I would take the Northwest Passage to find the hand of Franklin reaching for the Beaufort Sea. Tracing one warm line through a land so wide and savage, and make a Northwest Passage to the sea. How then am I so different from the first men through this way? Like them, I left a settled life, I threw it all away, to seek a Northwest Passage at the call of many men, to find there but the road back home again. Ah, for just one time, I would take the Northwest Passage to find the hand of Franklin reaching for the Beaufort Sea. Tracing one warm line through a land so wide and savage, and make a Northwest Passage to the sea.
Okay, after taking a look at the amount of time I have left, I think I'll save my main rave for either the last section of tonight's podcast or else maybe even for next week. This professionalization thing is a long and complex topic, and we're going to be hearing a lot about it in weeks to come, so we got time. Now, before I launch into one of my major tirades, there's some more background I need to give you guys, and this is about money. No, this isn't a fund appeal. I need to lay a few home truths out for you guys on the whole subject of money and the movement. That's going to be a discussion of the topic of white nationalist movement finance. I mention this because you generally find that a lot of such discussions are really a fund appeal in disguise. This isn't, believe me. If I was appealing for money, I'd be a hell of a lot more tactful. Now, most movement personalities are terrified to discuss this topic of money openly. Then the movement, financial transparency, simply does not exist and never will. And not just because revealing our sources of funding is dangerous to everyone involved, although it certainly is. It's because under the best of circumstances, the truth about movement money and the way we raise it and what we do with it doesn't sound very nice when you come right out and say it. Well, that's pretty much the way with everything in life related to finance. I mean, let's face it, money is a pretty crass subject altogether. Okay, basically, there are three ways that white nationalist groups raise money. A, they sell things, books, or newspapers, or pamphlets, or CDs, or DVDs, or stuff about their favorite conspiracy theories, whatever. A lot of activists basically became booksellers in their middle age and old age, and I've got no problem with that. The movement needs booksellers to keep our ideas and our knowledge alive. Of course, nowadays it's CD and DVD sellers as well, and although some people used to sneer and say, oh, so-and-so never does anything anymore, meaning the so-and-so wasn't running around in public wearing a costume and a silly sign anymore. He's just a book peddler now. Well, there is not a damn thing wrong with being a book peddler, just so you don't try and deceive anybody to the effect that you're something else. B. Movement groups charge membership dues for some kind of organization, which for some reason certain people among us claim to find utterly unreasonable and outrageous and the mark of a quote-unquote con man. Especially ex-National Alliance people, for some reason, they will just get apoplectic at the very mention of the word dues. Maybe it was because they got ripped off so bad under that regime from Hillsborough. Anyway, C. White racial movement groups just plain pass the hat and take donations. Now, there is a fourth method that deserves at least some mention. Down through the years, virtually all of us have been approached at one time or another by somebody who says, I got an idea, Harold. Why don't you start a business to raise money for the party, and that way you don't have to go bugging people and begging for money all the time. Yep, yep. And every now and then somebody tries to do just that, or else they try to work white nationalism into an existing business. Now, the thing is, that's been tried, and it's never worked worth a damn. For some reason I've never fully understood, movement people simply don't make good businessmen, possibly because movement people do have some kind of values in their lives other than money. And if you're going to be a businessman, you need to be focused on the almighty dollar and nothing else. Now, there have been some exceptions to this. We've had some fair to middling successes in the business sense, if not in the political sense, like James Warner, Ed Fields, William Pierce, and, of course, the ultimate right-wing businessman of all time, Willis Cardo. But what invariably happens is that either the racial and political aspect of things fades away and it becomes all about the business, like when Rick Cooper and some of the old California right crowd formed a carpet cleaning company called ST Enterprises for several years, or else the movement part of it grows like the blob and it devours the business end. For example, at one stage, George Dietz of Liberty Bell Publications was one of the most successful real estate brokers in the state of West Virginia. He was a millionaire. But he got involved in racial politics, and it ended up devouring everything he had. Now, I don't know if George is still alive. If he is, he's very old. But the last I heard, he'd lost everything, lost his farm. He was almost blind. He was living in the city, and he had only his Social Security as an income. Now, another interesting and frankly disgraceful aspect of white nationalist funding when it comes to donations is that those who give the most are those who can afford it the least. Anyone who has been involved in the right wing or the Aryan racial movement for any length of time at all can come up with a score of anecdotes about how cheap our quote-unquote supporters are and how generous the poorest and the most destitute whites are when one looks at the proportional aspect of their giving. I can't count the $20 checks I've received over the years from elderly people living off Social Security, from prisoners' commissary accounts, from teenage boys and girls who have sent me their allowance, from working men whom I know personally and to whom I know that 20 bucks meant shoes off their children's feet or food off their table. And I deeply regret to say that I've also received $20 checks from people who included a note to the effect of, "Dear Harold, I know how important your work for the National Socialist cause is, and I knew I just had to get this to you before I left on my European vacation. What is wrong with this picture?" And then they fly off to Europe feeling good about themselves because they remembered to kick in 20 bucks before they went off to squander 20,000. That's what gets me. I remember a guy we had back in the day who would give me a $5 or $10 donation at some really critical time when I had an urgent bill to pay. And to be fair, back then that was a lot more money than it is today. But who lived in a split-level suburban ranch palace. He had two cars and a brand new monster pickup truck in his garage. He spent at least $5,000 or more per year on Civil War reenacting. And he owned several full Confederate infantry and cavalry officers' uniforms, accurate down to the last detail, as well as a whole armory of functional black powder weapons, including the only working Henry repeater I've ever seen, all of which set him back over $10,000, as he was quite proud to tell you. Now, the cartridges for the Henry alone cost something like $4 a round. The last time I visited his home, admittedly this was many, many years ago, he merrily challenged me to a chess game using his $276 hand-cast Civil War chess set with pewter pieces, cannons as rooks, cavalrymen as knights, Jefferson Davis and Lincoln as respective blue and gray kings, etc., etc. What's wrong with this picture? Some of you may remember a guy named Dennis Mahan, the one who was accused by the loony left media of being involved with the Oklahoma City bombing in a Christian identity commune called Elohim City, which, by the way, Dennis never heard of before the media brought it up. Anyway, Dennis once described to me his efforts when he was running for mayor of Tulsa to get some kind of financial support from a prominent revisionist who was living in Tulsa at the time, a guy whose name some of you older people might recognize. Now, this was a man who owned three homes and who admitted to being worth more than $1 million. Our candidate finally, literally, got down on his knees and begged for this man's help. The guy finally gave him a check for $50 and told Dennis, and I quote, "This is a loan. I want it back if you don't win." What's wrong with this picture? Movement cheap bastarditis sometimes gets so bad that I've even seen a normally very mellow individual like Ingrid Rimland occasionally lose her temper with all of her free riders, and she lets them have it. She threatens to purge their lazy lurking asses from the Z-Gram list or whatever it is she's running at the time if they don't start coughing up something to keep Ernst going over in Germany or support one of her literary projects. Okay, I'll deep six the Grandpa Simpson Ancient Mariner rap, and I'll cut right to the chase. The simple fact is that now we have the internet, there is no longer any excuse for the Northwest Front or any other right-wing or racial cause being underfinanced. Now, I've already stated that we get between 3,000 and 4,000 hits per week on our website. Now, let's make some vague generalizations here. Let's say our actual weekly listenership is 3,500 people. And of those, 500 are hostiles of various kinds. FBI monitors, Secret Service monitors who hope they can catch me saying something some U.S. attorney can pretzel twist into an alleged threat against the main Munkoid. SPLC monitors, ADL, Israeli intelligence, Scott Spidell and Alex Linder, yada, yada, yada. Let's just say 500 people who are not realistically going to support the Northwest Front no matter what. Okay, that leaves 3,000 of you every week who tune into this program who are more or less supportive in that you're racially conscious whites, you like my books, and you'd like to see a Northwest or American Republic, kind of, so long as it doesn't involve any risk or inconvenience to you. Now, that's our baseline, 3,000 people. So, what do we do with that 3,000 people? Let's say that through some miracle, I or that national organizer we don't have yet, the guy who will have the silver tongue necessary to persuade you people to act that I don't have, Anyway, let's say someone can persuade these people to contribute $10 per month, the price of a 12-pack of cheap domestic beer once a month. Now, that's $30,000 a month or $360,000 per year. Well, let's further assume that by the same miracle, we can persuade these 3,000 people to kick in an extra $100 per biannual fund appeal, the Fault Building Campaign in October, and the Spring Appeal in the Fuhrer's Birthday Month of April. Now, let's be honest, $100 simply isn't that much money anymore, and most people can generally find $100 for something they really want in the way of consumer goods or toys. Now, that's another $600,000 per year for a total of $960,000 per annum. Let's throw in $40,000 per year in book sales. And that's $1 million per year that we could bring in just from all of you guys listening right now. And all you'd have to do is give up a 12-pack once a month and have your family stay home from Applebee's twice a year. Now, that $1 million a year is the price of the life of a race, our race. That $1 million a year is a party. That $1 million a year is a Northwest Volunteer Army. That $1 million a year is a revolutionary movement created by a mere 3,000 people, and with no real strain or pain, just the little bit of extra effort that one gives to something that's worth doing. Just the little bit of discipline necessary to drop that $10 check or money order into the mail once a month. $1 million a year. That's our general headquarters. That's my personal assistant who's going to keep me from being buried alive in emails about, Harold, Harold, you got to look at this video. That's Colonel House working full-time on Northwest Videos and Movies. Come down to it, that's our independent movie company that I spoke of a few weeks ago. That $1 million is our Northwest agency providing serious job and accommodation assistance to deserving Northwest migrants. That's enough money to stock an inventory of my own books so we could actually sell them on the internet and out of a literature room. That's gas and motel money for me and others to go driving around the Northwest homeland, meeting people in their homes and setting up local units, you name it. That $10 a month out of your pocket is our Northwest American Republic, but you won't give it to me. You won't give it to us. You won't give it to your people. Most of you would rather have the beer. And this doesn't just apply to the Northwest Front, not by any means. You could do it for Billy Roper if you want and give him something to really run for president with. You could do it for Kirk Lyons and give him the money to hire a dozen more attorneys for the Southern Legal Resource Center so that poor white people in the South wouldn't be quite so much at the mercy of the FBI and the courts. You could have done it for Ed Fields and saved the last tabloid newspaper we had, The Truth at Last. But you'd rather have the beer. It's not happening. It's never happened. So far as I know, no one in the movement has even begun to make it happen. No one in the movement has made a dent in getting the vast number of people who hang on to our movement for the ride and the free entertainment to kick in the price of admission. It's not just Harold Covington you guys won't support because Harold is so wicked and horrible and says such unkind things about your favorite fearless leader. You won't give fearless leader himself that $1 million per year either. With fearless leader as well as with the Northwest, you prefer to have the extra 12-pack every month. Why isn't it happening? The usual line is, well, we want guaranteed results, read you want entertainment. But that doesn't make it happen either. We're not a movement. We're a three-ring circus with a cage full of baboons. That's bad enough, but the fact is that most spectators don't even want to pay the price of admission. They want to sneak in under the tent and watch the clowns and the animal show for free. They don't seem to understand that if they just wouldn't be such cheap bastards and cough up the price of admission, the price, I repeat, of a 12-pack of cheap domestic beer, Milwaukee's Best or something like that, once a month, the circus might be able to afford to hire some lion tamers and some other decent acts and really give you some entertainment. Now, this gets into an interesting question. Suppose that somehow we were able to trot out a finished product rather like unveiling a new car in a showroom. All of a sudden, there it is, a real Aryan Revolutionary Party, the Northwest Front, here in the Northwest, with all the basic plant and equipment, the building, the library of racial books, the computer and printing equipment, the staff, the membership kicking in the $10 a month, and the covert supporters regularly sending in checks with significant number of zeros. The local units and the trouble trios being formed, the tabloid newspaper hitting the streets every weekend for paper sales, the media coverage. Would things be any different? Well, yeah, in point of fact, based on the one example we have, that does tend to produce a result. As witness the one time we know of when someone was able to suddenly spring up from the earth with a proper, fully equipped, fully staffed by full-time paid people and properly set up racial nationalist operation. The National Alliance of Dr. William L. Pierce. After that, $300,000 mysteriously fell out of the sky in 1983. All of a sudden, a few months later, there it was. An actual, for real, right-wing racist compound, by God, sitting up there in Hillsboro, West Virginia, with actual, real people in it. No more grubby post office boxes in nigger neighborhoods. No more riding the bus around D.C. for the good doctor. No more little cubbyhole rented by the month offices in Rosslyn stacked up with cases of the Turner Diaries. No more rented motel banquet rooms, but actual land with vegetation and green stuff all around, and no niggers or Mexicans in sight. A place where white people could come and gather and breathe free for a bit. Once that compound at Hillsboro appeared, thanks to that unknown generous patron back in 83, the National Alliance took the lead in the movement and didn't relinquish it for almost 18 years until Pierce died. Anyway, do you guys see one of the biggest problems that I face in trying to keep on pulling rabbits out of a hat and keep you entertained so that even the 3,000 or so listeners we have don't lose interest in the show and wander away? Somehow or other, the rabbit has to get fed and watered and put into the hat before I can pull it out. I have this horrible sinking feeling that at some point in the future, after white people have vanished from the face of the earth, God or the gods or the cosmic force or the great pumpkin or whoever will erect in some sad supernatural wasteland of a dimension, a kind of big 2001 Space Odyssey obelisk kind of thing, a kind of psychic memorial or tombstone to the white race. And on that tombstone will be inscribed this epitaph. They could have lived. They could have had a homeland. But they preferred the beer. This is Saga.
Bringing it out.
tell you what, let me explain to all of you exactly what I mean by professionalizing the party. And then when I'm done, you can all send me your lame excuses as to why we can't have it and you just can't possibly help us out with this. Oh, no, not at all. I say lame excuses because, as I've just explained to you, even if not one of you will actually get your asses up here where you belong, if you just all kick in that $10 a month in voluntary dues, or subsidy, or love offering, or whatever the hell you want to call it, I could buy the help I need like Pierce did. I can tell you from my own experience in Arlington and from talking to people who knew Pierce's operation back in the day and Willis Cardo's setup even to this day that if so much as a whisper goes out through the movement grapevine that there is either a free flop or glory be a salary, an actual salary for full-time racial work going anywhere around the country, all of a sudden the desert, which was empty, suddenly blooms with waving palms, palm side up. You've got everybody from eccentric PhDs to the t-shirt youth to biker meth heads lined up down the street for that room or that salary. I've said it before, our problem has always been to get you people to do, as white men, because it is right, the very same things that as Americans you would do without a moment's hesitation for money. Like packing a moving van and getting the hell out here where you're supposed to be. I have witnessed this phenomenon time and again. The minute the movement gets a whiff of money, be it from an armored car robbery or an eccentric millionaire croaking and leaving somebody some cash, whatever, then all of a sudden, all things are possible. I proved that when I blew my family inheritance on the NSPA back in the late 1970s and early 80s. Once the pump is primed, the water will flow, at least until the character issue chokes us up again. Anyway, here is what a proper Northwest Front should look like. First off, we need an office or headquarters of some kind, not an old Chicago-style headquarters with screaming scum demonstrating outside, but a genuine place of business where a huge volume of actual work is done. This headquarters or office should be known to our own people, but low profile in public. Ideally, no one outside the party should even know we're there, including the police. We can call it Northwest Relocation Consulting or something, which wouldn't be far from the truth. This general headquarters office facility, be it in an office building, a house, whatever, needs to have the following features. Number one, a meeting or conference room with an actual table and chairs where people can sit down and actually be seated comfortably for lengthy meetings or discussions. Indoors, out of the cold and the rain, with such amenities as bathrooms and a coffee maker at least. You'd be amazed how often in the past we've been expected, seriously, to hold get-togethers in freezing, rain-swept public parks in November because no one would volunteer their living room, because they were too afraid, either of the secret police or of some of the creeps who might show up at the meeting. Now, I am not totally comfortable with having meetings in our people's private homes, but it's all we've got so far. Now, so far, we haven't had any nasties slip in, either spies or just plain movement dysfunctionals, but there's a first time for everything. If some rat is going to lead antifas or reporters or attorneys or cops to our door, it needs to be to an office and not to somebody's home, maybe with children in it. Number two, this facility needs to have a properly equipped internet radio production unit in it, including a soundproofed studio so Axis Sally and I don't have to shout over motorcycles outside, screaming fire engines, ringing telephones with telemarketing calls, so forth and so on. A studio with phone lines or else firewalled Skype to keep all those damn viruses out, from which we can actually run a proper show, maybe a call-in show, maybe with a webcam so that it can be almost like a TV show. Of course, I don't know if Axis Sally's up for TV, so don't worry, Sally, I'm not making any plans for you yet. But this general headquarters facility I speak of needs to be as stable and as secure financially and otherwise as possible, so that when we commit to doing a live show for, say, 2 hours a day, 3 hours a week, we can be sure that we will keep that commitment. Number three, we need a fully trained and skillful full-time IT person to maintain all of our computers in this general headquarters, plus the stuff related to the internet radio studio especially. Number four, in one office in this general headquarters facility, we need something I refer to as a Northwest Agency, based on the Jewish Agency which handles Jewish immigration to Israel, headed by a full-time migration officer, whose sole function is to recruit and assist qualified, carefully screened migrants to the Northwest and get them placed with NF teams or crews all around the homeland. This migration officer will have the authority and the wherewithal in especially deserving cases or emergency cases where a white family is physically at risk from niggers or Mexicans or some other kind of persecution to provide actual financial and relocation help in the form of accommodation sometimes, and not to mention hands-on assistance in finding a job, that kind of thing. Now, to my personal mind, this includes, if necessary, having five or six of our guys rent a U-Haul and drive to Galveston or Memphis or Chicago or New Jersey if necessary, where they will physically extract and move at-risk but destitute white families out of niggerized and beanerized neighborhoods where they are in physical danger and bring them home to the Pacific Northwest. Now, the migration officer would have to decide when such intervention is merited. Me, I would prioritize any such case where there was a child at risk. I know, there's going to be some of you out there, you Darwinian types, who say, screw them, it's their own fault they're poor and fucked up because they should have played the capitalist system better. Let them come home on their own bat or else die. But if we have the resources to help other white people suffering from persecution at the hands of America, then I say we help first and shake our fingers at them and scold them later. That's a habit we need to acquire, helping our own kind first and running our mouths afterwards. You hear that, Spidell? Number five, I will have a full-time personal assistant who will keep me from being buried alive in email and pieces of paper, and who will free me to deal solely with the creative end of things. I do, in fact, have a part-time volunteer assistant right now, a very good one, who does a great job when he is here. But because he has to work in the city in order to make ends meet in a depression, and because gasoline is becoming so prohibitively expensive that he can only get down here to Lewis County to be with me once or twice per week these days, he can't manage fully to do everything I need him to do. I need to be able to hire this young man on permanently, if at all possible. Now finally, as a matter of urgency, we need that national organizer. The man who will actually deal with the people end of this Northwest Front thing and transform it from a one-man band into a proper political movement. He's the one I really want to meet and hire once you guys get it and start kicking in your dues money so we can pay him. The trouble is, we haven't found him yet. Now, you know those postings of northwestfront.org and the link to last week's Radio Free Northwest that you didn't post last week? Well, as it turns out, our future Commander Rockwell of the Northwest was on one of those boards one night. But because you got lazy and you decided that you wanted to get drunk and play World of Warcraft instead of posting Radio Free Northwest, or you wanted to get drunk and watch American Idol or internet pornography, or you just plain wanted to get drunk, or because every time you log on to your computer you just sit there passively and read and absorb it all and never post at all, anyway, because you were AWOL, our guy missed it. The man who will one day lead the Northwest American Republic to victory went onto a site or a bulletin board where he should have seen your post and gone to northwestfront.org and been transfigured. But because you were fucking off, he still doesn't know that we exist. Oh well, better luck next time. I sure hope we'll have better luck next time because we really need this guy, whoever and wherever he is. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Underban. Freedom.